www.themouthmagazine.com.
It's a pleasure to be able to say, for the second time, Wilco Johnson, welcome to the Mouthcast.
Oh, thank you very much.
How are you, sir?
How am I? Let me have a look around. I think I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. It's good,
good.
It's really good to speak to you again, not least because the last time was about 2 weeks before your cancer diagnosis was revealed in 2012. obviously, that news came as a great shock to a lot of people. But I think what was almost more shocking was the vigour with which you approached your life after that diagnosis. Being told you were going to die seemed to give you a new lease of life.
Oh, well, absolutely. I have to say that that year, which it turned out to be just over a year, it turned out to be in the end, was I don't know, it's very hard to think of the word, but it was, it was one of the most marvellous years of my life. It didn't freak me out. I mean, obviously, you know, when it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you're having a good think about it, it's not too much fun.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, my whole consciousness then was just this intense awareness that I was in fact alive, you know, and I mean, normally we don't care what it is to be alive, you know, we take it for granted.
Yeah.
You know, and we can't help it, you know, we can't walk around thinking, oh, it's marvellous to be alive, you know, but it changed everything, you know, and that was quite something.
Yeah.
And then not only that, but I thought, oh, blimey, what am I going to do, you know? For some reason or other, strange things happened. You know, like, the first thing I did was I decided to go to Japan. I've been there many times. I have many friends there. And I thought, right, I will go to Japan, say goodbye to everybody. And while we were there, I was with my friend Benjamin Taobao. He's a one-man blues band, French guy, right? And we've shared many an adventure over the years, you know. This is one of the craziest. And we got, then we did things like we put on a gig in Tokyo to raise money for the tsunami disaster fund, you know, which had just happened the year before. And oh man, that was fantastic. It was like this place was ram-packed. The street was ram-packed. They had monitor screens out in the street, so the people that couldn't get in could watch the show.
Fantastic.
You can imagine. You imagine the feeling, right? You got this kind of sea of Japanese faces all in tears and that, you know. But me, I'm not in tears. I'm thinking, this is great. I was realizing for the first time, you know, I mean, I knew people like me then, you know, they dug the music and all that, you know, but this was so personal. It was pretty moving. And yeah, man, we raised a lot of money. In fact, I received a letter from the president of the Japanese Red Cross thanking me.
Wow.
For the money I'd raised. I never expected a thing like that in my life. Yeah. And this was the first of so many things that happened that I would just never have expected. So that whole year was something else.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you remember feeling unwell leading up to the diagnosis?
No, well, the thing was that see, I had started noticing this lump in my stomach, right?
Right.
It kept changing shape, you know. Sometimes it was short, sometimes it was long, sometimes it seemed to disappear altogether. Now, a normal, sensible person would have thought, you better go and see about this. But me, I decided to treat it by ignoring it and hoping it would go away, right? Which I must warn anyone, don't do that. But I did it, and eventually as I say, it didn't hurt. You know, I could press it, and it didn't hurt. But you know, there was obviously something not right. Mm. Then eventually my son came to visit. He took one look at it and sort of grabbed me by the collar and dragged me down to the A&E, you know, and said, come on. and that's where the whole thing started, you know. We went down there, had a look at it, you know, and then I found myself in a doctor's room. And I'm looking at this doctor, and the doctor says to me those words, you know, you've got cancer. And I felt absolutely calm. I didn't freak out. I thought, oh. He told me that the cancer was inoperable and that I had perhaps 10 months to live. I still felt very calm. I walked out of the hospital, and I remember walking out of the hospital and looking at it's winter time, beautiful winter's day. And looking at the trees against the sky and thinking, oh, God, this looks beautiful. It looks beautiful. And suddenly I got this rush. And I thought, I exist. I just felt great. I felt absolutely great. I went home. It was really weird. I went home. I was sort of walking around my house and thinking, well, man, you know, I've been through some weird things in my life, but this is the weirdest. You know, I'm going to die. What I decided to do was, if I had 10 months, I was just going to enjoy those 10 months the best I could. I was not going to go and look for miracle cures or second opinions or anything like that. I thought, I'm just going to carry on until I drop. And that's the thing. Definitely not going to have chemotherapy or anything. I said, do you want chemotherapy? I said, no, I don't want to lose my hair. So we kind of left it at that, yeah. My decision I'm not going to fight against it. As long as I feel a bump was growing bigger and bigger. After two or three months, it was like it was the size of a melon. And in fact, when they took the thing out, it weighed 3.25 kilos.
Okay. This is that's
a big old tumour, you know.
That's about 8 pounds, isn't it?
It's big. Think about the size of a lemon. A melon.
Yeah.
My stomach, I looked pregnant, you know. It was swelling out. You had to buy new clothes, you know, and all the time I felt, well, I can play. I did gigs in Japan, gigs in festivals, you know, Cornbury Festival, Fuji Rock, and stuff like that. And of course, that's fantastic. I mean, the thing is, you get on stage, man, and everybody knows you're going to die. And that's the last time they're going to see you. And, oh, man, you can't go wrong. They all say, hooray, hooray. Yeah, man, you know. And that was something else. That was so, all in all, mad things like happened. Like I got asked to go and present an award to Elton John. And I made a little speech, and I gave Elton this reward thing. And what he did was, he walked up to the microphone, and he says, I'll tell you what, I don't deserve this reward. He says, Wilco does. And he gave it to me.
Fantastic. You know,
and there it sits now on my mantelpiece. And what do I think about Elton John? I think Elton John's a gentleman.
There was a second opinion, and it came from a fan who was a doctor who actually told you there might have been a misdiagnosis, and that was the case. And in April 2014, you had your pancreas, your spleen, part of your stomach, part of your intestines removed in a 9-hour operation. 11-hour. And, wow. And the tumour as well. And the surgeon who operated said that it was no exaggeration to say that you had been taken to the limit of what a human being can take.
So they told me, for one thing, when I first met Mr. Hugay, the surgeon, I bow down.
Yeah.
You know, this guy, and I put such faith in this guy.
Yeah.
And he told me that he thought it was perfectly feasible, although it was at the very last minute, to remove this thing. And I just put absolute faith in him. I mean, I thought, actually, I've had a pretty good life. And in many ways, this is a great way to end your life. Either they're going to cure me, take this thing out and cure me, or I'm going to die on the operating table. But either way, I avoid suffering. You know, freaky. They explained to me that when somebody goes into deep anaesthetic, when they recover, they're often completely disorientated. They don't know what's happening. So I thought, okay, I can handle that. I've been plenty of situations where I don't know what's happening, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, I remember waking up in this quiet ward and thinking, hey, man, you know, everything's cool. They cured me. It's worked. Oh, man. And then slowly, the idea grew on me that they were planning to murder me.
Wilco.
And I'm lying there and I'm thinking, oh, none of my friends were. It's a night time, right? Just the night staff were there. And I think, what am I going to do? They're definitely going to kill me. And I'm thinking, come on, man. They're not going to spend all this money on a bloody operation just to cut your throat.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But man, I was scared. And eventually, one of the nurses came up And I said to him, there's something wrong. And he's going, no, everything's okay. I said, no, man, there's something wrong. And I couldn't say the words. I couldn't say, you're going to kill me. I couldn't say it. And I'm sort of lying there thinking, what am I going to do? All my friends are a long way away. You know, they're not in this world. What am I going to do? Eventually, I thought, well, I've got to take it in my own hands. I've got to do something. And I stood up. And I thought, you know, this thing they stick in your neck.
Yeah.
You know, this catheter or whatever they call it. And I started to pull it. And suddenly all the nurses rushed across. And I can remember their hands, their arms holding onto my arm, trying to stop me from doing this. So I'm struggling. And I pulled it out and I went bang and said, and blood splashed across the bed.
Oh, man.
And I think at that point I went unconscious.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, so weird times, but God bless Adam Brooks Hospital. I mean, man, what they did for me.
Yeah.
What they did for me. And they put up with crap like that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, earlier when we talked about getting the diagnosis, I understand actually how someone who's given the news that you were given could feel elated, like, you know, there's no time for any more bullshit, there's no time to waste,
there's
no time to experience things only at half measures. But I guess the other side of that, in fact, I think I spotted this a little bit in Julian Temple's film, The Ecstasy of Wilco Johnson, which is a fantastic piece of work, by the way. But by the end of that film, I got the feeling that now you were cured, it was almost like you felt you'd been sentenced to live. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. It does. The thing is, when you first receive the news, when you hear those words, you've got cancer, it's all of a sudden, bang, it's a shock. And as I say, as it happens, I felt very calm. And I took it in my stride.
Yeah.
But on the other end, when you're cured, it's not instant. What you've got there is weeks and months of lying on your back, weak as a kitten, dependent on the nurses and friends and all of that, you know. And it takes a long, long time to really understand, man, it's all over. You've had a year believing you're going to die, more than a year, you know. I'm just about now. I mean, like, what, 2 years gone by?
Yeah.
And I'm just about now thinking, I'm just a normal human being again. You know, I'm not a ghost or a revenant or whatever I am. And again, it's a marvelous kick, you know, to walk on stage, and that year when I was ill, you know, to be able to walk on stage, and you haven't got anything to prove, man. You've got no future, you've got no past. You just got that moment, and it's a marvelous feeling. That's the way it should be all the time. You should go on your stage and do your thing, you know, and forget the bloody mortgage and the everything. And so should everybody in that room.
It's about that room in that moment, isn't it?
Well, yeah, living the moment, you know, it's an easy kind of phrase to say, but when you're forced on, it's forced on you by an extreme situation like that. It's quite something. Live in the moment, man, because you don't know when the next moment's going to come.
So I guess receiving the news that you were cured, like you say, it takes a long time to dawn on you. So I imagine it's actually quite easy to slip into a depression after that.
Well, I mean, it seems to sink into lots of things. I mean, for instance, after the operation, and when I'd started getting back on my feet again, which did take a long time, I was so weak, man. I'm trying to walk around the block for exercise. Yeah. I've got this Japanese bird with me, right? And she's going, "You'll go around block." And I go, I don't want to go round the Brook. And she goes, you'll go round Brook. And I go, all right. And so we walk round the block and walking along like an old man, you know. You're walking along like an old man. And your body's going, go on, man. Go on. Why don't you sprint a few paces? Why don't you jog? And you go, I'll tell you why I don't, because I bloody well can't.
Yeah.
But it's all... I think it's all better now. You know, apart from I've got this massive Mercedes sign radiating out from my belly button.
I've seen a photo of that scar.
Yeah, which I'm quite proud of, actually.
Yeah, do you get it out and show it to people?
Oh, well, I do. I go, look at that. Yeah. You know, you come and show me your tattoo. I'll show you this.
During that year that we've talked about, there was a massive outpouring of goodwill towards you.
Mm.
Love, almost. And obviously the importance of Dr. Feelgood in shaping British music can't be understated. But in some ways, I think that's maybe gotten a bit buried over time.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just a long time ago, you know.
Yeah, but all of a sudden, because you were so much in the public eye, there was this huge reminder of it, and people were able to join up the dots, if you like. Were you?
Yeah.
Did that mean anything to you, or was there any sort of feeling of, well, I told you this all along?
Well, not really. I have this thing now. I mean, I cannot go out, walk down the street. If I walk down the street, or if I walk down Oxford Street or something, people come up to me and shake my hand. And that's quite a buzz, you know. I've got this thing with my son, right? Every time it happens, we go, one.
Okay.
It comes out of mine, two. How many did you score today? Three, four, you know. Oh, man, that is such a touching thing. You mean enough to people that they are willing to sort of walk up to a stranger and shake his hand. And yeah.
But I don't imagine you like to be thought of as a national treasure.
Well, no. Now, use that thing. Man, I'm not a national treasure. There's lots of national treasures. I mean, Mr. Hugay, who cured me, that's what you call a treasure.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I just amuse people, man. And I'm not ashamed about that. That's what I do. I think I do it fairly well, and that's brilliant. But I have, over this year or so, come to meet people who are national treasures, you know, who've devoted their lives to easing suffering and maybe one day to curing this suffering. And they're the treasures.
Yeah. I remember when last we met, talking about your role in Game of Thrones a little bit, or more about the fact that it was easy for you because all you had to do was give people hard stares,
yeah.
Which was what you'd been doing for most of your life. So yeah. I wanted to ask you about that kind of public perception of you, because the night we talked, before I came into the dressing room to meet you, I was slightly terrified, but I found you... I found you to be an absolute gentleman, really, really thoughtful and very, very sensitive, actually. So I wondered if that hard stares thing, that kind of aura around you, is like a protective shield.
I do remember back in the 70s and Dr. Phil was happening and I was building that reputation, and it was quite good because there were two things. One thing that you didn't really have to talk to people you didn't want to talk to.
Yeah.
You know, you just give them a look like that. And another thing was that actually people wanted you to be like that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like they would have been disappointed if you weren't a little bit weird, you know. I mean, it's like if you went to interview Keith Richards and he gave you cucumber sandwiches, I mean, you would be a bit upset,
yes.
Wouldn't you? You know, it's kind of like that.
Well, I do remember at the end, as I thanked you and you thanked me and I walked out, you went, oi, and I turned round and you gave me the hard stare.
Yeah.
Did that develop as a bit of a consequence of being in the music industry, or did it go back further than that? Were you always kind of wanting to keep people a little bit at a distance, if you like?
I don't know. I always used to think about it like, you know, I'm not a tough guy. You know, I grew up on Canby Island, and if you want to protect yourself, and somebody's threatening you, if you just look at them the wrong way, they'll think twice about it. And I think that's where I learned it. But I'm not. I'm a pussy.
Let's talk a little bit about your book, your recent book.
Mm.
It's a mighty piece of work, actually. I found it really funny, but also very moving in places. We did talk a little bit last time about Irene, your wife, who sadly passed in 2004.
Yeah.
You said to me that life had given you everything you want, that you'd got everything you could possibly want, and that you were fairly content, except for the fact that you didn't have Irene anymore. There was a real dignity to what you were saying. I think losing her changed your life as much as finding her had.
Yeah, and I'm afraid it's still with me, you know. I read in an article somewhere that grieving takes 3 years or 4 years or something, but I mean, it's been 12 years now. And I mean, just the other day, you know, Lou Lewis, Lou came around my place, and we're sitting talking, and then suddenly Lou got up and he was looking at these photographs on the mantelpiece. And I'm sitting behind him, you know. And then I realised he was crying. And so I got up and stood next to him. And we were looking at this picture of Irene. And we were both crying.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of guy she was.
Yeah, yeah. In the book, you're not shy of talking about the infidelities that kind of come hand in hand with being in the music industry, which I actually found very, very brave of you, because it's not often that somebody would be quite that honest in a book. You didn't airbrush your faults out of it, and that's obviously one of the reasons why it's a great book. I'm guessing it was very, very important to you, for yourself, also for Irene, and for your sons.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, it goes with the territory, you know. Like, you can't help him, man. There's all these women, and I don't know. Another thing about me is I don't tell lies. Irene knew all these people. There weren't that many. I used to keep a girlfriend or two, you know, when I had the money. Yeah, so Irene was friends with them, and they were friends with Irene, and that was just a kind of period of my life, you know, and sometimes it was just part of the story. I mean, I could have made more of all that, but I mean, it's very difficult to talk to any rock musician and they haven't indulged in that. Now, yeah, it's impossible on the road. I like girls. So sometimes, in order to make a point during the book, I had to say that, there was this person, you know, that was there, that took some part. So, but I mean, I made as little of it as I could. I mean, I didn't, because it was Irene, I love her, you know, it was Irene. I just spoke about things like that when it was necessary. I didn't want to bloody Hello magazine.
Big expose sort of thing.
Emissions admissions and stuff like that. I ain't saying that they didn't mean anything to me, because God, I love. Girl, well, used to, man. I'm 70 now, you know.
There's still life in the old dog yet, though, surely.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I say, I got the sense from the book that Irene, of course, absolutely the love of your life.
Well, absolutely. She was. She was absolutely the love of my life. She looked after everything. You would never have heard of me if it wasn't for her.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Irene, I love her still, and all my friends that used to know her love her. She was very lovable, and we make regular excursions to stand around her grave and think, you know.
Yeah.
And I bought myself a grave beside her, so one day we're going to be lying there together. Hopefully not arguing.
www.themouthmagazine.com